Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, which changed the course of China away from halting efforts at democratic reform and has led to the current leader for life, Xi Jinping's reactionary rollback of any liberalization as Chinese nationalism and patriotism are being stoked by the communist government's ubiquitous propaganda machine. Orville Schell, the former dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, who is now the director of the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations and is the co-author of Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century, joins us. We will discuss the significance of the Chinese government finally acknowledging that the massacre took place, although their defense minister at a conference in Singapore did not mention the bloodletting, but rather explained that the government had to restore stability. With a strong man in charge turning back the clock and a trade war with the United States brewing, we will assess whether the competition between the number one global power in retreat and the number two global power on the rise will remain friendly or could turn more belligerent. Then we'll look into the slow-boiling constitutional crisis underway in America as an attorney general who has placed his client, President Trump, above the law, while the president himself is breaking the law in order to goad the House Democrats into impeaching him because he thinks that's his best way of getting reelected in 2020, dominate the narrative, while the Democrats struggle to keep up with the brazen legal thuggery and contempt for conventions and norms. David Rothkopf, who was a senior official in the Clinton administration and was editor of Foreign Policy magazine and is the author of the forthcoming book, Traitor, The Case Against Donald Trump, joins us. We'll discuss how our reality TV president rose to power with free media and an ability to create the narrative via reality TV stunts could ultimately be brought down by reality TV if the Democrats start televised impeachment hearings. Then finally, we will speak with Sumi Terry, a senior fellow at the Center for International Strategic Studies and the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, as well as the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. She joins us to assess the accuracy of reports that North Korea's Kim Jong-un executed his nuclear negotiators who set up the failed Hanoi summit, and what impact that will have on Trump's continuing love affair with Kim, who writes beautiful letters to him. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Orville Schell, who was formerly the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and is currently the Arthur Ross Director of the Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations. His books include Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square, and The Next Generation of Chinese Leaders. And his latest book, co-authored with John Delury, is Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Orville Schell.
Pleasure.
Well, thanks for joining us on this 30th anniversary, I guess, of the Tiananmen massacre that took place in the spring of 1989. Just for some context going back, I recall at the time that Gorbachev, the Russian leader or the Soviet leader at the time, was visiting at the time that when the students occupied Tiananmen Square, initially because of their admiration for Hu Yaobang, who had just died, and the premier at the time, Zhao Jiang, was considered a moderate, if not a liberal. And of course, what happened in Russia was that Gorbachev brought forth both perestroika and glasnost meaning speaking freely, was supposed to stimulate perestroika. But what in fact happened was that the Russian people, the Soviet people, were able to say the emperor had no clothes and the whole place fell apart. It looks like the Chinese learned their lesson from Gorbachev. They've allowed perestroika, economic liberalization, but they have not allowed glasnost. Would you agree?
Yes, I think, and that was the sort of sad result, I think, of the 1989, the events that with which you're familiar. You know, what happened was that Gorbachev was coming to Beijing to sort of bury the hatchet and end the Sino-Soviet feud. And this is going to be a grand moment. And China had issued hundreds of visas to journalists from all around the world, including satellite licenses for CNN to come and cover the summit. But after all that happened, and as the journalists all started coming to Beijing, the demonstrations began to memorialize the quite liberal party general secretary, Hu Yaobang, who died. And so the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, was put in a very awkward place, because on the one hand, it had Gorbachev coming. It had close to 1,000 foreign journalists in town, and it couldn't crack down on the students under those circumstances. So it was forced to wait till Gorbachev's visit came. And then he couldn't come to Tiananmen Square for his 21-gun salute. It was very embarrassing to have him have a state dinner in the Great Hall of the People with close to a million demonstrators outside. So that was the sort of denouement of the events there. And then when he left in around May 20th, May 19th, that was when the party decided to crack down. And the first, group of PLA soldiers started marching into the city.
But, of course, this was the end of Zhao Jing. He did seem to be a leader that I don't know whether in retrospect, we're placing too much hope in his liberalism, but it did seem like he was a reformer and at least didn't want to kill the kids, at the very least, right?
Well, Zhao Ziyang was the party general secretary. He had been the premier, and he had presided over the latter part of the 1980s, which was one of the most extraordinarily sort of yeasty, open, and in many ways, exploratory periods in 20th century Chinese history. He was, I wouldn't exactly call him a liberal because he was a party member, but he was open. And he played from both sides of Deng Xiaoping's great reform agenda of reform and openness, a little bit like Russia, like perestroika and glasnost. And so on the one hand, they reformed the economy, marketize it. On the other hand, there were tremendous amounts of relaxation in publishing, the media, academia, free speech, museums, think tanks. All of these institutions became much more unfettered by the party. So when he got cashiered because of his refusal to crack down on the students, that was a very stark milestone in China's progress, and really the end of those reformist 1980s.
Well, clearly the Chinese since then, the communist government, has been successful in replacing aspiration for democracy, which were expressed by the goddess of democracy that the students put together, the statue, and all of their activism. It was all across the country, and a sense of freedom and speech, which was, just blossoming. It looks like, rather cynically but very successfully, the communist government has replaced democratic aspirations with nationalism and materialism.
Well, I think very sadly, the message that they took away from both the demonstrations and then the collapse of the Soviet Union 2 years later, which they attributed to Gorbachev's reforms, was that if you do open up politically, and even if you allow too much marketization and relaxation of party control over a centralized economy, you were signing, in effect, the death warrant of a one-party system. So that was the kind of the sad message that came out of the crackdown. And, China has a deep and abiding fear of chaotic, occurrences happening. And because it's had such a tempestuous 20th century, such a divided 20th century. So it was those that the party was able to play on And once they quelled the demonstrators and then they cracked down in a very draconian fashion, there were a number of people who sympathized with them because they felt there, but for the grace of God, we would be in the Soviet Union's footsteps, breaking apart our well, you could call it an empire, I suppose, but at least the reunified notion of China.
So how much do you think, is there any of the sort of embers, if you will, still burning under the ash in terms of democratic aspirations in this country where Xi Jinping has rolled back the clock, created his own cult of personality as Uncle Xi? Obviously, the biggest boneheaded thing that Trump did, well, he's done a lot of boneheaded things, but one of the first boneheaded things he did was get rid of the TPP, which was more than a trade agreement. It was more of a political arrangement to have the neighborhood kind of constrain China and force China to play by the rules. Throwing out TPP, you can see a direct correlation with Xi Jinping turning back the clock. Am I correct in identifying that, Orville Schell?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, we see two very errant tendencies. One, of course, is China's increasingly more autocratic bent and really a return to a kind of a neo-Maoism in certain ways, not completely. On the other hand, in American on the American side of the ledger, we have Trump, who has sort of part of the China equation correct, the part which understands that the playing field was not level for businesses, for NGOs, for academic institutions, for the media, et cetera, and that something had to happen to make it more reciprocal and more equal. That part he got. The part he doesn't get very well is how do you do it? In other words, how do you pressure China in a way that's constructive rather than destructive? And the chaotic nature of the Trump administration, I think, often mitigates against some wiser heads that he does have in middle-reaching positions in the White House and elsewhere that are trying to establish a new balance. So, in effect, we have both sides of the equation now out of kilter. And that means it's very, very hard to come to any kind of a conclusion. And we have a kind of a more intensified contradiction between China as a manifestly self-declared authoritarian government out to dominate the region, the South China Sea, Taiwan, the East China Sea, and the United States that's trying to find some new angle of repose with China, with a president that's sort of careening from one side to another.
And again, I'm speaking with Orville Schell, who is now the Arthur Ross Director of the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. His latest book, co-authored with John DeLurie, is Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. Now that the Chinese government have managed to bury history and to scrub the memory of the democratic uprising, which was put down by a military force in 30 years ago at Tiananmen Square. What's your sense, Orville Schell, of how the remarks by China's defense minister at a conference in Singapore, he, for the first time, they acknowledged that the massacre took place, but of course said that it was necessary to restore stability?
Well, the Secretary of Defense, Wei Fenghe, interesting, his name in Chinese translates peaceful phoenix way, did take a rather hard line in Singapore at the Shangri-La dialogue. And we see that the kind of notion that somehow engagement, which presupposes the U.S. and China are slowly converging, is really completely ended now. We are diverging, not converging, and we get increasingly hostile rhetoric on both sides. He did acknowledge that the 1989 demonstrations and the crackdown happened occasionally on official will, and he justified it in the name of stability, which of course is China's official line. So I mean that was not too startling, but this is the way in which China now perceives that the party must rule. It cannot allow a lot of free thinking, free institutions, whether it's civil society or universities or even companies. whereas over the last few decades, the party has withdrawn from companies. Now it is moving back into companies. It's owning stock, even in private companies, and it's requiring party committees, Communist Party committees within private companies. So there is a very regressive move back to a much more Leninist form of government, which, of course, influences the whole trade dispute and the trade negotiations, because you can't have a statist planned economy with national champions and China 2025, made in China 2025 policies and all of these things and subsidies of key sectors going on, and still be in the World Trade Organization. So we are increasingly at loggerheads on many, many fronts, not just trade.
Well, but isn't there an asymmetry here between our leadership, which is quixotic, mercurial, largely incompetent? I don't think this president ever thought he would get elected. And according to Michael Cohen's testimony, he kept thinking that the thing was whole thing was a lark in order to promote the Trump brand. And now he's surrounded by lightweights, because nobody with any decency and character and experience wants to work for him. So you've got people like the Rasputin-type character whispering in his ear, Stephen Miller, about, you know, slapping a tariff on the Mexicans on and to gin up this war on the border. And you've got Peter Navarro, his trade rep on China, still insisting that these tariffs are paid for by the Chinese, when in fact they're paid for by the American consumer. So just contrast that kind of crew that I'm talking about here, or at least describing in my own way, obviously, with this resurgent communist government in China with a long view, its Belt and Road, et cetera, initiative. And so how do you see the alignment of forces here if, in fact, things are to turn away from a friendly rivalry into a more belligerent environment?
Well, I think there's no doubt about it. There's a certain amount of, unclear in concept in the White House. And Trump, as we all know, he's a very mercurial, unpredictable leader. And I think the Chinese are as thrown off balance as we are by that. And in a certain sense, that's a good thing. Because if you believe, as I think most people now do, that the relationship was out of balance in some fundamental way and needs some corrective policies, it needs to be readjusted, then you need to have the Chinese in a frame of mind where they're willing to make some concessions and to adjust. That's not Xi Jinping's strength, however. So even though Trump has successfully gotten his attention, they haven't been able to fix the relationship in a meaningful way that makes it more functional and more equal. And I think for many reasons, that fault lies as much on the Chinese side as on Trump's side. So there's plenty of fault to go around here. And I think even though one may be appalled by many of the things President Trump does, you do have to recognize that he had properly identified an imbalance that was heading the relationship with China towards a cliff if it didn't get fixed. But the question is how to fix it now, given the rather stormy and chaotic relationship that's been engendered.
Well, Orville Schell, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Orville Schell, who was formerly the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, and he's currently the Arthur Ross Director of the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. His books include Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square, and The Next Generation of China's Leaders. And his latest book, co-authored with John Delury, is Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how our reality TV president, who rose to power via reality TV, could be brought down by reality TV.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world. But the Murphy family is my boss. The voters of the world keep supporting me. And I promise to take you very far. Other mothers better not upset me. Or I'll send a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me to win, I sincerely like to thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who's CEO of the TRG Media, producers of podcasts including National Security Magazine and Deep State Radio, which Rothkopf hosts. Previously, he was a senior official in the Clinton administration and also the editor of Foreign Policy magazine, the author of The Great Questions of Tomorrow. His forthcoming book is Traitor, The Case Against Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Pleasure to be back.
Well, thank you. And you've been tweeting out some, I guess you, with the Twitter in chief, somebody's got to fight back. And you've just tweeted, I believe Trump should be impeached. I believe Barr should be impeached. I believe McConnell should be impeached. I believe Jared and Ivanka should be stripped of their security clearances and fired. I believe the Trump administration officials who ignore subpoenas should be jailed. It is a surreal situation where you have an attorney general who has placed the president, his client, above the law, and the president himself is now breaking the law in order to goad the Democrats into impeaching him because he thinks that's his best chance of getting reelected. You couldn't make this stuff up.
Well, yeah, although I'm not 100% sure that I buy into the story that the president is goading people into impeaching him. He seems to be afraid of impeachment, and I think there's some good reasons why he is. I think they have a deliberate strategy of essentially testing the limits of the law, testing the power of the Democrats in the Congress by ignoring subpoenas and by encouraging the Democrats or goading the Democrats into taking them to court, because they think that at the very worst, this is going to delay everything for months and months and months. In the best case, it's going to, you know, defeat the Democratic initiatives in the court. And in any event, it's going to make the Democrats look weak. And I think that's precisely what's happened. I think we've entered into a period where 5 months after the Democrats took over the House of Representatives, there's nothing really to show for the power they acquired. Trump is, if anything, more empowered and operating more independently of the Congress. And part that's because of a Trump strategy, and part it's because of a McConnell strategy in the Senate, where he essentially has said, Trump gets a carte blanche so long as I get the judges that I want, because McConnell's playing a long game. And he's also himself rather compromised by Russian money and the whole Trump-Russia case, which he played a role in resisting the pursuit of by the Obama administration. And so, you know, we are in this situation, and I think we have to accept that if the Senate Majority Leader and the majority in the Senate do not wish to hold the president accountable, and the attorney general acts on behalf of the president and not the American people, then the president is above the law.
Well, is this a case, though, in terms of the American people, who are the spectators in this reality TV show that we have in the presidency, where it's government by stunt and every day he has to pull off something? And, of course, he's learned that one of the few toys that he can play with unilaterally are pardons and tariffs. So he's pardoning and slapping tariffs on in completely insane way. But it all feeds that sort of cycle of distraction, which, you know, as a journalist, I'm caught up in it. You know, I feel like I'm being manipulated just talking about Trump. But is it to do with a cynical American saying, nice guys finish last? Is that what you're hinting at here, David, that because the Democrats look feckless and Trump looks strong, that's all that matters? They don't care about the morality. They just want somebody that appears to be effective.
Well, I don't think the issue is how people appear. I think it's how they are. And I think that McConnell has essentially said, well, you can call me anything you want. I don't care what you call me. And Barr has said the same thing, and going so far this week as to say, well, you know, everybody dies. We don't take our reputations with us. And so I think they're all saying, look, you know, make your speeches, you know, decry the president, threaten to impeach. But so long as you don't do anything with teeth, we get to do what we want, and we're going to. And that's hardball. That's realpolitik, and that's the way they're playing it. And I think the Democrats are playing into their hands to the extent to which they do not pursue more aggressive investigation, more aggressive legal challenges, find ways to penalize people who ignore subpoenas or who flaunt the law, and do so with a sense of urgency. And, you know, I happen to be of the belief that, first of all, there's a constitutional duty to impeach when the president has serially committed many crimes, as this one has, and that you do it whether or not it's politically popular. As it happens, right now, the 41-ish percent of the American people who support impeachment is exactly the percentage that supported impeachment at the height of Nixon's crisis. So people are reluctant to do the right thing, even when it's the right thing. Further, I think that, you know, one of the reasons that impeachment is something that Trump actually does fear is not impeachment per se. I think he thinks he has an ironclad defense of the Senate's refusal to convict. It's that there would be a many months long trial, day in and day out, dominating the news coverage, day in and day out, revealing new crimes, whether it's many counts of obstruction or whether it's conspiracy with the Russians or whether it's money laundering or whether it's federal election law violations or whether it's tax fraud or whether it's playing fast and loose with handing out security clearances or on. There are 20 cases against Trump out there. And that would take a toll. Remember, Trump just barely won the last time. He knows how precarious his situation is. And that if 1% of the people who voted for Trump switched over and voted for Democrats will win the presidency. He knows that, and he knows that reality TV is powerful. And I think one of the things we have to recognize is that an impeachment investigation and impeachment hearings would be reality TV with real teeth. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, there would be some poetic justice if Trump were to gain what he's gotten by reality TV and lose it by reality TV.
And again, we're speaking with David Rothkopf, the CEO of the TRG Media, producers of podcasts including National Security Magazine and Deep State Radio, which Rothkopf hosts. Previously, he was a senior official in the Clinton administration and also the editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's the author of The Great Questions of Tomorrow, and his forthcoming book is Traitor, The Case Against Donald Trump. Well, of course, immediately, Trump's behavior, according to what... You know, the Oracle finally spoke, Robert Mueller, after a couple of years of investigation. He finally spoke for 10 minutes last week, and he started out warning the American people about what the Russians had been doing, hacking into our elections, and how they will continue to do so. And then at the end of his 10 minutes or so, he circled back to the Russian issue, emphasizing it again and saying that all Americans should be concerned about what the Russians are doing. Well, there's one American who's not concerned, and he sits in the Oval Office. I, for the life of me, can't understand why people can't see that there's a problem there.
I think most people do see that there's a problem. I think the number is something like 8 in 10 Democrats think the president of the United States ought to be impeached. The president's approval rating has never gotten much above 40%, and his core support seems to be around 33%. America's standing in the world has fallen dramatically. Foreign leaders speak contemptuously of the President of the United States, most recently the Mayor of London, prior to the President's visit to the United Kingdom later this week. The reality is that I don't in my lifetime recall a president who's held in lower regard or who's viewed with more distrust than this particular president, for good reason. You know, we're 10,000 lies into the Trump presidency. So there are people, you know, there's a kind of mini industry in journalism counting the president's lies. There's a mini industry within the judicial world of cases against Trump, and more of those are likely to come. This is just, you know, a power game where the people who see Trump as a potential ticket to achieving their goals, like McConnell, like the Kochs, like the dark money people, like big corporations who want more deregulation, like some foreign powers that benefit from his policies, are saying, let's ride this as long as we can. I think, you know, time's running out for him. And, to be honest, I'm not sure whether it's going to run out for him for all the good reasons that you imply or that we talk about sometimes here. I think it's going to run out for him for a completely different reason, and that is we're going to go into a recession. You mentioned his tariffs earlier. These are taxes on the American people. China's our, you know, a top trading partner. Mexico's a top trading partner. And this is going to slow down the economy. And, you know, we've seen stock market fall fairly substantially. Not that that's a great indicator, but it's an indicator. And, you know, at that moment, Trump's going to lose his support on the right. And I think that, you know, it may be that really stupid trade policies, and Trump has the worst trade policies. I was a senior trade official in the Clinton administration. Trump has the worst trade policies of any president since the Smoot-Hawley era. It may be that really dumb trade policies are what do him in and reveal that the only reason he had the support of sort of big money is because they thought they could make more money off him. When they stopped being able to do that, they're going to drop him like a hot potato.
Well, I think the motive behind Barr being Trump's lawyer in such a craven way is to do with the fact that Barr is a very close friend of Leonard Leo, the head of the Federalist Society, who puts all these sort of Opus Dei-type right-wing judges on the federal bench. So I'm sure they, both Leonard Leo and William Barr, are perfectly happy to have Trump in as long as they hand him the list of judges and him and McConnell get them on the bench. But I wanted to touch on what you brought up, David, and that is the idea of the irony, perhaps, that the reality TV president will be brought down by reality TV. And we know that he was extremely freaked out by the testimony by Michael Cohen, and that's why he's stopping these subpoenas and refusing to have McCann and others testify. And the Democrats are making a big deal about getting Mueller to testify. I think that's a huge mistake. If you want to deal with reality TV, shouldn't you schedule the program? Like Trump always has a cliffhanger at the end. If you start impeaching now, you've got months to go. Why not hold back and have Mueller testify late? For example, when you finally take the thing to the Senate and everybody says, oh, Mitch McConnell will shut it down right away. Well, he can't. The person who presides over an impeachment trial in the Senate is the Chief Justice, John Roberts. So it's out of McConnell's hands, isn't it?
Well, no, because I think, you know, at the end of the day, two-thirds of the Senate has got to vote to remove him, and you're not going to get that.
Right. As long as there are, but you're going to get the information out, aren't you?
Yes, I think you are. And I think, you know, that happens in the impeachment hearings in the House as well. And I think, you know, there is some argument to be made that it might be better to do that a little closer to the election, because at the end of the day, the only way that you undo the sort of iron grip that Mitch McConnell has around the Senate and loosen the grip of people like the Federalist Society and Leonard Leo and these others is you have to take the Senate back. And I do think, by the way, that if the case is made well, and then senators say, well, yeah, I don't care that he's a tax fraud, and I don't care that he's a money launderer, and I don't care that there are 100 meetings with the Russians, and I don't care that he obstructed justice 10 times, and I don't care that he, you know, flaunted, you know, security laws to, you know, to give clearances to Ivanka and Jared, and I don't care that he's made tons of money off of the United States government as president or had a corrupt inauguration process, or we could go on. And, you know, I think that's a good way to help fuel some of the campaigns that need to be waged against Republicans in the 22 or so Republican Senate seats that will be open come the next election. And, you know, so I do think the Democrats do need to approach this a little bit with the attitude of a TV programmer and say, what's the right time to do this? How long should this take? How do we make this case airtight? How do we do investigations in the House that then lead into real impeachment vote in the House? And how do we package that in a way that it reaches the most American people so that when we get to a vote in the Senate, we know that the vast majority of American people are not going to be supportive of pure partisanship on their part, or perhaps, you know, we'll end up where we ended up with Nixon, which might be Trump saying, well, you know, I'm going to have to resign. And, you know, frankly, I think there are pressure points that might make him want to do that.
Well, just in closing, Trump really got freaked out when Nancy Pelosi said he was engaged in a cover-up. And to my mind, the real cover-up is Trump himself. What Trump's enablers and the staff around him and the family and those close to him are doing is covering up the fact that if you spend a minute or two with this guy, you realize he's completely off the wall in his own world. And I've done some research when he came onto the political scene with a lot of businessmen who dealt with him, and they all said the same thing. And this friend of his, Donny Deutsch, is out there on MSNBC saying all this stuff. It's no mystery. So if you could get a camera into the Oval Office for a couple of minutes for the American people to see who their president really is, he'd be over in a heartbeat, wouldn't he?
Well, we don't know. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I thought this is going to finally do him in. And, you know, every single day there's some new revelation or act, whether it's Barr's obstruction or it's, you know, but, you know, obscuring the name John McCain on a destroyer in Tokyo Harbor, it's, you know, it's absurd and destructive tariffs, or it's at the latest episode of obstruction of justice. You know, you think, well, that would end anybody else's career. And so far it hasn't done it. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, the only thing we can count on is mobilizing the American people and putting an end to this administration at the ballot box. And I, you know, that's soon, right? We're, what, 15 months away, 16 months away from the election? That, you know, we're going to be in the midst of that very, very soon. And, you know, I think we have to work in that direction. But that's not to say that we shouldn't pursue impeachment. We should pursue every avenue. You know, when these guys violate subpoenas, they should be penalized. They can be fined. Why have they not been fined yet? Why are we not pushing harder in court on many of the cases of subpoenas being ignored? Jerry Nadler sent out 81 subpoenas. About half of them were honored. Why aren't those people in there? Why aren't these hearings taking place? You used the word earlier that the Democrats have been feckless. I think they have been too cautious. I think that is a hallmark of the Democrats going back throughout the Obama administration. I think that is something that the Republicans are feeding off of. And so, yes, the case against Trump is strong. Make the case. Stand up to him. Be tough. And I think to a large extent, you're starting to see some of the Democratic candidates for president recognize that that's what the people want to see. And so Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris and some of the others are standing up in a tough way and saying, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. And I think they are going to gain in a lot of popularity because of that. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if one of those two women ended up being the candidate.
Well, David Rothkopf, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO of the TRG Media, producers of the podcast, including National Security Magazine and Deep State Radio, which Rothkopf hosts. Previously, he was a senior official in the Clinton administration and also the editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's the author of The Great Questions of Tomorrow, and his forthcoming book is Traitor, The Case Against Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing the accuracy of reports that North Korea's Kim Jong-un executed his nuclear negotiators who set up the failed Hanoi summit.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sue Mee Terry, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Strategic Studies, and she was previously a former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sue Mee Terry.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you. And what do you make of the idea that, or the rumors that Kim Jong-un, because of the failed Hanoi summit, had to find a scapegoat because in terms of the way that dynasty has ruled North Korea, the only analogy that I can find in history would be Imperial Japan with the emperor worship. And so he is essentially a god, or he's infallible like the Pope. So he had to save face. So did they sacrifice Kim Hyok-chol, the North Korean special envoy to the United States, who set up the Hanoi summit?
Well, what is for certain is that he has been purged. Now, whether he has been executed, that we need confirmation, because that's from one source. It's a good source, a North Korean who is currently living inside North Korea, and this person has a track record of giving an accurate intelligence on previous purges. So I'm inclined to, in this report is credible, but whether he's executed or not, we still have to wait for that. But having that said, what is indisputable is that in a country like North Korea, in a system like North Korea, as you said, purges like these are a routine, absolutely a routine. And what is indisputable is that Kim Jong-un has killed off in the past, right? Or purged number two men before, his uncle Chang Sung-taek, Vice Marshal Cho Ryong-hae, Vice Marshal Hwang Pyeong-soo. These were all once second most powerful officials in North Korea. So, you know, as Thomas Hobbes said, in North Korea, indeed, life of a number two man is nasty, brutish, and short. And Kim Jong-chol was responsible for setting up this summit, which has failed. Hanoi summit was undoubtedly a failure, and the Trump snub was unprecedented embarrassment, huge loss of face for Kim Jong-un. So it's absolutely expected that someone has to pay. Someone has to be a scapegoat.
So the worst job in the world is to beat the number two person in North Korea?
Absolutely. Why, I don't know why anyone would take that job. In fact, if I was Kim Jong-chol, now Kim Jong-chol, number two guy, he's reportedly has been purged, not executed. And it's Kim Hyok-chol, who is Steve Envoy, our North Korea envoy's counterpart. He has been supposedly executed. But either way, they are the fall guys because they are the ones who negotiated with the United States. They were part of the delegation that came to Washington in January, and since the Hanoi summit did not go well, they had to be purged. Now, if I was Kim Yong-chul or Kim Hyuk-chul, I would have took off after Hanoi. I would have defected right then and there because this is not a surprise. They had to be purged.
And the source for the information that Kim Hyuk-chul was executed in March at the Mirim Airport in Pyongyang, apparently, according to this North Korean source that you mentioned, he was charged with being recruited by U.S. imperialists and betraying the supreme leader. Do we know whether or not he was killed by anti-aircraft weapons, which is apparently Kim Jong-un's favorite means of dispatching his enemies, blowing them apart with anti-aircraft guns?
Right. He has done that before. So we, you know, he has done that to someone who fell asleep while he was speaking. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's true, but we don't know yet, because we have not heard how this guy has been killed. But again, what is not a surprise is that they should have expected to be purged. You know, look at what happened. Remember when Kim Jong-il died in that funeral? There were eight pallbearers, and now six out of those eight have been purged. They're gone. So again, purges are normal. It's expected. And then when you also look at Nodong Shinmun, the North Korean commentary that came out recently in that's main Workers' Party newspaper, it had all this rhetoric of anti-party, anti-revolutionary acts having to be met with stern judgments. So that sounds like justification for purges to me. So I'm not surprised that these men were purged. We'll have to wait and see whether Kim Hyuk-chul was indeed executed and how he got executed.
And again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Strategic Studies, and she was previously a former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So this information about the purge and the execution of the person who set up, who was the envoy to the U.S., Kim Hyuk-chul, that came out of the South Korean newspaper Chosun Ilbo, which has been mostly accurate, but occasionally they've got it wrong. But you're saying the source for that story comes from North Korea, from a reliable source. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so Chosun Ilbo in the past obviously have been right and wrong, because it's really hard to get a story like this right. So Chosun Ilbo is relying on a single source, but again, this particular source has been right in the past. And there, it's not only also Chosun Ilbo. There's a Donghwa Ilbo reporter who is a North Korean defector. And this defector also confirmed this report, and he is a trustworthy source as well. And Chosun Ilbo, which is the largest daily paper in South Korea, they know that they will face backlash if this report is indeed false. And it's very easy to be false. Like, only thing that North Koreans have to do is, you know, show Kim Hyuk-chul's face again, and then now Chosun Ilbo has egg on his face in terms of the paper. So they must have had confidence on the source before publishing it like this. And again, when you look at circumstances surrounding this purge, I have expected ever since Hanoi. So I am inclined to believe that these people have been purged, although, you know, I have to wait and see whether the execution part is true. But I would not be surprised if this guy was executed.
Well, of course, the U.S. Special Representative to North Korea, Stephen Begun, says he doesn't know. He referred the press to the statement by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who also doesn't know. Clearly, the Trump administration are a little embarrassed because of Trump's valentines to Kim Jong-un. He said, you know, that they're in love. I mean, what more?
Absolutely.
Swooning
Trump
like
said he has been fallen in love, or they are in love over most beautiful love letters ever exchanged. Mm. And if you saw President Trump, well, you heard him in when he was in Japan recently, when he directly contradicted his own national security advisor, John Bolton, and Prime Minister Abe, when he said, you know, these short-range missiles are not really in violation of the United Nations Security Council resolutions, and they don't really bother him. Of course, the short-range missiles are in violation of United Nations Security Council resolutions because they don't specify it has to be long, medium, or intercontinental. All ballistic missiles are banned from North Korea. So you can tell from that that President Trump is very eager to move along on engagement and dialogue. So this kind of news is obviously he doesn't welcome it because it makes Kim Jong-un look like a bad guy or a tyrant, which he is.
Right, but not only did he throw Bolton under the bus, he threw Abe under the bus because when Trump said it was no big deal, these May the 9th launches of these two short-range ballistic missiles, which according to the South Korean defense minister could well be Russian-made Iskander missiles, but nevertheless, if they're short-range, they can certainly hit Tokyo. So it sort of came across like the Americans don't care about North Korea nuking Japan as long as their missiles don't reach the United States.
I think absolutely you're right about that. These missiles are directly, they're a threat to Japan and South Korea. And by commenting that they are not a big deal, yes, the United States is making a point that, you know, it's only a big deal if it's intercontinental ballistic missile that threatens mainland United States and we don't care about allies. So I think that was an unfortunate statement from President Trump.
So what do you think's going on in North Korea? It's obviously opaque, and I've been hearing rumors that situation there is as bad as it's ever been in terms of food supplies, global warming, bad harvests, obviously bad agricultural practices. There's apparently some attempt at giving a little more freedom for people to grow crops and own some stuff themselves. But there's also apparently an epidemic of drug-resistant tuberculosis. And there are even reports that Kim Jong-un's own sister may well have contracted drug-resistant tuberculosis. What do you know about that?
Well, their North Korea's health system and food situation system, food situation has always been a disaster. That's it's a consistent humanitarian crisis going on in North Korea. And yes, I think we are hearing that food situation is pretty bad. That's why United Nations World Food Program and so other NGOs have all came out and said, you know, we need food assistance. And South Korea, in fact, was ready to send some rice, food aid to North Korea. So I don't doubt the situation is internally bad in North Korea. Also, when you look at Kim Jong-un's ask in Hanoi, what did he ask for? He asked for massive sanctions relief. So I do think that North Korea is hurting internally, and this is why for Kim Jong-un, he does need sanctions relief. The problem is the United States, for Kim Jong-un, we're not ready to give on sanctions relief without North Korea doing more on the denuclearization front, like giving us a declaration on their nuclear missile program and a timeline and a roadmap and so on. So we are at an impasse here, and I'm not sure how we'll be able to break through this impasse. And one of the implications of these people having been purged is that these people that have been purged used to do inter-Korea relations. They were not really from foreign ministry, right? Kim Young-chul and Kim Hyuk-chul. So now things will have worked out badly for them. It just means we're going back to the foreign ministry people. But these inter-Korea people are not going to be able to negotiate or talk with the South Koreans when they need food aid and help from South Korea, because all these people are now gone. So I think this is one of the fallout also of these recent purges, tying directly to inter-Korea relations and getting some food aid from South Korea.
But the idea that the Chinese and the Russians are incentivized to maintain the sanctions, I don't see that happening, surely. I mean, with relations with Russia being as they are and with Trump declaring a trade war against China and ramping up tariffs, I can't see what incentives there are for the Chinese and the Russians to stick with these sanctions. And I believe there's quite a lot of sanction busting going on.
It's true. And in fall of 2017, when the United States was pursuing maximum pressure policy, we finally saw Chinese, and Russians too, but Chinese in particular, really implementing sanctions. And, you know, Korea watchers like myself was pretty surprised the Chinese were willing to do that. And this is, again, in the fall of 2017, in the middle of the, in the height of the fire and fury rhetoric and so on. But you're right. After now, Kim Jong-un have met with Xi Jinping, Chinese president, three times. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has also gone to Vladivostok and met with Putin. He has really normalized himself in front of these leaders. And now in the middle of this heightened tension between the United States and China, there is a less incentive for China to, and Russia to implement sanctions. And in fact, we are hearing reports that implementation of sanctions are loosening. We hear this almost on a daily basis.
Well, surely, though, the Chinese and the Russians, at a bottom line, Sumi Terry, they don't want North Korea to collapse, right? So, again, you get back to speculation about how can that regime hold on? The brutality is obviously extraordinary. But is there a limit to brutality? Will brutality always work? I mean, I was talking to somebody the other evening who visits Zimbabwe a lot, and Zimbabwe has been a basket case where the currency is worthless and the food supplies are terrible. People are oppressed. There's an even worse crook called the crocodile, who was the guy that threw all of Mugabe's enemies into the rivers to be eaten by crocodiles. That's how he got his nickname. He's running the place now. And, you know, with decades of deprivation, and it's starting to happen also in Venezuela, at a certain point, people who are hungry and oppressed just don't have the energy to revolt. And so is that the – and I know that there's also in North Korea this weird Juche ideology and all this paranoia and this emperor worship stuff going on as well. But where do you see cracks in the future?
So because North Korea is still most isolated, cut off, cultish, indoctrinated place on the planet, the public does not have ability to mobilize. There is no Wi-Fi, social media, internet access to the normal, ordinary North Koreans. They have one TV station, one radio station. They're indoctrinated. They don't get outside information. So it's hard for these people to get mobilized. When you look at Arab Spring kind of situation, like in Tunisia, your social media played a huge role. So I still don't see an ability for people to organize themselves into some sort of an uprising. What I do see crack is particularly potentially with the elites, because the way the regime survived for so many years, so many decades, is because of the elite loyalty or elite support, right? So in the mid-1990s, in the middle of famine years, millions of people have perished. But as long as the elite support the regime continues. But with this kind of level of brutality, Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung purged people too, but the level, it's the way in which Kim Jong-un gets rid of the elites. It's just unprecedented. So I think this level of brutality will make the elites feel insecure. And so it might help in the short term because elites are scared of Kim Jong-un. But over the long term, I don't see how elites can continually support Kim Jong-un like this. So I see that as a potential source for instability for the Kim Jong-un regime.
Well, Sumi Terry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Strategic Studies. Previously was the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Down in America.
One more light goes out in the